from the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham. This is Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonida Inge. 9 years ago, three young Muslim Americans were murdered in Chapel Hill in a case that received national and international attention.
The FBI is launching a preliminary inquiry into the Chapel Hill shootings that claimed the lives of three young Muslim students.
23-year-old Dia Barakat, his 21-year-old wife Yusur Abu Salha, and her 19-year-old sister Razan were all fatally shot.
All three shot execution style, a bullet to the head.
Police suspect that the motive to be a long-running dispute over parking, but family and friends of the victims are asking it to be investigated as a hate crime.
Filmmaker Tarek Al-Baba is here to talk to me about his documentary on those murders. It's called 36 Seconds, Portrait of a Hate Crime. And later in the conversation, we'll be joined by Durham District Attorney Satana DeBerry, who worked on the case, and UNC Law Professor Joseph Kennedy for some context. Tarek, welcome to Due South, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I guess the first obvious question is really, how did you first hear about these murders?
Like many people, you know, it kind of spread like wildfire for our community specifically, right away on Twitter, on Facebook. I actually grew up in North Carolina. I grew up in Charlotte. We had family in Raleigh and Durham area. And so outside of the kind of social media and Twitter, I also was on text message threads with family members because we were very concerned. When it initially happened, it was shooting in Chapel Hill, Muslim students dead. And so we had cousins and nieces and nephews in the area. So we were genuinely concerned that something
it
may
was
have
somebody
happened
that it may be somebody you knew.
Exactly. And so as more information came out, we established that our immediate family was safe. However, one of my cousins, Haytham Saime, actually knew the victims and had been texting Dia Barakat throughout the day, and he was very distraught. So that was kind of initially how it was brought to my attention.
And then now we're at the point, you know, as hours and days passed, you know, what did you come to learn? I guess that was enough to, trigger something in you and really make you want to tell this story.
Yeah, I think for folks who are from communities of color, folks that are from, you know, minority groups, we knew something was rotten in Denmark right away, right? It's like, wait, three Muslim students, 46-year-old white male, issue over parking. It just didn't sit right with us. And even if you didn't look at any of the facts, we knew kind of in our gut several things. We knew that the media wasn't going to portray the actual events the same way they would be portrayed if the tables were turned. Immediately, one of the things that we all felt right away was, if this had been, you know, a brown man named Muhammad and, you know, three white students, immediately you would be hearing about terrorism, things would be locked down, they'd be looking into the guy's, you know, history and his uncle's. And so immediately we were already kind of on high alert. We were already upset, and we were just kind of waiting for, you know, a proper investigation into what had really happened.
And before we even got to that point, because the investigation seemed to be moving slowly, you know, the case, this particular case, you just think of all the international attention, like it just wasn't North Carolina, just wasn't just this country. You know, I read about vigils for the victims in Gaza City in the aftermath. You know, talk to me, I guess, a little bit more about the impact you saw on Muslim communities, even abroad.
I think right away we saw ourselves in these beautiful children. We there's this false narrative. There's this, you know, portrayal of who Muslims are, Muslim Americans are, and whether it be Hollywood or in novels. And so when we saw these three beautiful college students who immediately you could tell that they carried themselves a certain way, that they were academic achievers, you know, people sharing their personal thoughts and feelings and experiences with them, we're like, that's who we are. you know, that's who I was. That's who my cousin is. So I think people wanted to rally behind this feeling of like, you know, we're going to stand in solidarity. This is a very close representation of who we actually are. And we're not going to be quiet about it. We're going to say that you deeply hurt us. You have to do the right thing and tell and investigate it properly and clear their names. It's not bad enough that they got killed execution style. Now you're, you know, essentially saying that they were out in the streets, you know, fighting with their neighbor. Like that just wasn't going to fly with our community.
Well, now, you know, it's 9 years after those murders. And so at what point did you say, you know, I need to make a film about this? I mean, because it had, I wonder how long it really took to for you to even convince the family members of those who were killed that you needed their voices.
So, you know, in the weeks and months after the tragedy, you know, I was following the news just like kind of everybody else. And I actually ran into my cousin Haytham, who again knew the Barakat family. Mm-hmm. And he's the one that kind of gave me that nudge of like, look, you know, the media's got this wrong. You know, they're still talking about it as a parking dispute. Maybe you could help with your background in filmmaking and television. Maybe it's something you could look into. I could introduce you to the family. So that's really all I needed. I think as filmmakers, we're always on the lookout to develop and create interesting projects that have, you know, many layers to it and layers of complexity and things that are, you know, socially relevant. So to me, it had all the right ingredients for a good film, but it was also personal to me because I grew up in the South and I was a senior in high school when September 11th happened. So I faced a lot of direct and indirect racism. And I just knew in my gut that like something this egregious was going to happen. It was just a matter of time. And so I wanted to, in a way, tell their story, but also the story of how so many of us felt about what has been going on and what has been transpiring for so many years. And so basically that fall of 2015, I did get an introduction to first Faris Barakat and spoke to him, you know, told him my idea. I had kind of like a loose outline of the key themes and issues that I wanted to address in the film while telling this very personal story. And it wasn't easy. It wasn't like he just said yes. He said, you know, we've been approached by many media outlets and, you know, we want to ensure that, you know, that we'd be working with the right caliber of filmmakers and that, you know, our goal and mission would be aligned. And so I put together like a pitch video of myself and what I wanted to do and what my approach would be and why it was so important to me. And he shared that with the Abu Salha family. And thankfully, they accepted my pitch. And we planned essentially for the first round of production to be around the anniversary of the murders. We felt that it would be strategic in a way because there was already so many events set up during that week. There was the vigil. There was several events of folks in the community giving back. So it was just like a real opportunity to kind of get to know the victims' friends and their families. But I also knew it was going to be a really raw time for them. And, you know, it's good for filmmaking in terms of just the authenticity of how they're feeling in that moment, recalling their children and what has happened leading up to that, you know, 1 year anniversary. So they knew it was going to be tough. I knew it was going to be one of the most challenging things I've done in my career to date at that point. But I'm really glad that we did it. That was a very successful first round of production. And, you know, as you know, we kind of kept going for 8 years after that to get the story right.
Mm. Well, we'll definitely continue our conversation. But first, I want to play a clip from the trailer of your film, 36 Seconds, Portrait of a Hate Crime.
Police say this may have simply been a fight over parking spaces.
Three children murdered over a parking dispute. Does that make any sense to anyone?
you really have to ask, why? Why were they targeted?
Reading the case, each piece fit together like a puzzle.
He said, I don't like how you look, I don't like how you dress.
Once you step back and you saw the whole thing, this motive was very clear.
He didn't just kill them, he executed them. There is a big difference.
We're going to come back with Tarek Al-Baba, director and producer of the feature documentary 36 Seconds, Portrait of a Hate Crime, and we'll get into the legal case and be joined by Durham District Attorney Satana DeBerry, as well as Joseph Kennedy of the UNC School of Law. But before our break, I wanted to play some tape, part of a statement made by Dia Barakat's sister, Dr. Suzanne Barakat, the day after the murders.
Dia, at 23, a second-year dental student at UNC, was well known for his all-embracing kindness, lightheartedness, dedication to community service, love for basketball, and anything Steph Curry. Yusuf, 21, who was on track to join him at UNC Dental in the fall, matched his gentle demeanor, had a calming presence, and she and Liat found in one another a kindred spirit. Razan, at only 19, was tremendously gifted, studying architecture, incredibly creative, giving, generous, and a loyal friend.
I'm Leonida Inge, and this is Due South on WUNC. Welcome back to Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonida Inge. I'm here with Tarek Al-Baba, director of 36 Seconds, Portrait of a Hate Crime, a feature documentary about the murders of three young Muslim Americans in Chapel Hill in 2015.
The case against the man accused of murdering these three people is coming to a close.
We're gonna get through this as a family.
Dia found a way to tell the truth even after his life was taken.
Not a single person moved. I mean, you can hear a pin drop.
Despite all the pain, we will not be changed. We will not let hate win.
That was a clip from the trailer, and we'll hear voices from the film in the course of this conversation. And I'd also like to welcome two more guests. Joseph Kennedy is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And Satana DeBerry is the district attorney of Durham County. And she held that office in 2019 when Craig Hicks pleaded guilty to three counts of first-degree murder for the killings of Dia Barakat, his wife Yusur Abu Salha, and Yusur's sister Razan Abu Salha. We'll hear how in 2019, DeBerry's team presented evidence of a history of interactions between Hicks and the victims, highlighting his bias toward them, and how they also showed a video in court, a recording Dia started before he was shot. It told the story of what happened in those 36 seconds. D.A. DeBerry and Professor Kennedy, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, all four of us were actually together at the Carolina Theater in Durham back in February to mark the 9-year anniversary of the murders. There was a screening of 36 seconds and a panel discussion afterwards, really including everyone here plus a couple of other panelists, but it's really good to see you all again to talk about this. You know, D.A. DeBerry, I want to start with you. You know, where were you when you first heard of the murders in 2015, and what were you thinking when you heard about them?
Well, I was not the district attorney in 2015, but I, you know, do live here and have lived here for a significant amount of time. And I remember when I first heard about it, I remember thinking, oh, this is going to be bad. I had no knowledge of anything at the time. I just knew that it looked, from what we had heard, to be horrible.
Mm. And it was.
And it was.
Yeah. You know, I know Professor Joe Kennedy, you lived in Chapel Hill. You still live in Chapel Hill. I'm a professor of law. So when this happened, you know, what was your reaction? What did you see, like, on campus around you?
Well, a crime like this sends sort of shock. I mean, all murders are terrible, but a crime like this sends sort of shockwaves through the larger community. It's hard to compare to anything else. And, you know, there were, you know, beautiful vigils on campus, but those vigils were there to deal with terrible, terrible pain.
Mm. D.A. DeBerry, when you did become the district attorney, and then, you know, I guess when you first started looking at this case, you know, it had been like, 4 years since the murders or so. What had happened in that time with this case?
Sure. Almost nothing, honestly, had happened outside of the investigation. You asked me what I thought about when I first heard about it. One of the things that I did not know until I became district attorney, of course, is that it had happened in Durham County. And so for your listeners who don't know, Chapel Hill is mostly in Orange County. And so it was not on my radar that this would be a case that I would have to deal with until I got to the office. And essentially, when I became district attorney, about the only thing that had been done, the investigation had been completed. I think the U.S. Attorney's Office had looked at it, and it had been declared a death penalty case. But other than that, it had pretty much stalled out.
I know Professor Kennedy, you know, there were efforts underway to get these murders prosecuted as hate crimes. The feds came all to town, you know, to look at everything and talk to people. But can you please really outline the hate crime law landscape for us, especially, you know, in the U.S., and how high of a bar, I guess, it is to reach?
Sure. Yeah. No, that's a great question. So, first of all, in North Carolina, you know, motive, you know, a hate motive can serve as sort of an aggravating factor for sentencing in a number of different contexts. We have a few special sort of hate crimes, right? You know, cross-burning, things like that. Generally speaking, in terms of what you have to prove, there's two different sort of approaches to proving something is a hate crime. One is that that aspect of the identity of the victim has to be essentially the reason for the crime. And the other approach is to require that it be a reason for the crime, right? And, you know, there's different jurisdictions take different approaches to that issue.
Mm. I mean, if you almost ask anyone on the street, they would say that it was a hate crime.
Well, I mean, in context, though, you know, a senseless, it's always hard to peer into the mind of sort of a senseless killer. And this, like most killings, is sort of really utterly senseless, right? I mean, so when a person commits such a terrible crime, you know, three shootings in a row, you know, that's a messy, messy mind. And having a clear story about whether, you know, this was like the reason, the only reason, or a reason, I think that's a hard thing to figure out.
Are you able to say, I mean, I'm not putting you on the spot, but like, what hate crime laws really exist in North Carolina now?
So right now, as I said, they can be sentencing aggravators. So if you commit a crime because of, you know, sort of hate, that can make the sentence higher. There are a few sort of special crimes that you might call hate crimes, like cross-burning is an easy example. But in a case like this, you've got three murders, right? You're already going to receive the harshest possible sentence, or the harshest possible sentences are already available under our law. So there's no need for sort of a sentencing aggravator when you've got sort of a triple murder. So the, you know, what happened in this case was at the sentencing hearing, the prosecution put on a fantastic sort of case laying out the argument that this was sort of a hate crime, but legally it didn't make any difference to the sentence. Because life in prison was already on the table.
Hmm. Mm. I wonder what were your colleagues saying about this? I mean, did you talk about this in your classes with your students?
Yeah, no. I mean, a crime like this, as I said, it just sends shockwaves through the larger community, and particularly through our community, right, which sees itself as sort of a liberal, tolerant, diverse community. And so, something like this, a crime like this, is felt for sort of years after when it's committed.
Tariq, I know in the film you tried to lay out the hate crime argument, like really from beginning to end, especially for folks like me, people viewing, so we could understand how the family felt and why this was so important to explain.
Yes, I mean, I think it's about correcting the narrative. So when Craig Hicks turned himself in, you see how jovial he is with the police officers.
It's Craig Hicks, right?
Yes, sir.
You mind if I call you Craig?
No, that's fine, Craig.
Just call me Scott, that's fine.
Versus right? Up late for dinner. Can't
you see that he's trying to create this narrative that these are punk neighbors.
I walked back there and I said, you got three cars in the lot. You're not supposed to have more than two. And I don't have a parking spot. I'm not parking on the street. I'm an owner there. These people are renters.
Okay.
And he said, we can park wherever.
They have no respect. They play loud music. They wake up his wife. They don't listen. They cuss me out. Hey, he even came at me with a knife.
He started making a movement towards me, so I pulled it real quick and started shooting. Maybe he came at and hit me with a knife or something. I don't know. But something cut my thumb. I don't know what else would have cut my thumb because it was bleeding all over the place. This is all my blood, I believe.
So if you're on the other, if you're on the receiving end of that, you're thinking, oh, well, maybe this is kind of justified. I don't like punk kids. I don't like people that come at me with a knife. That's self-defense. Or maybe, you know, just the how many times he talks about these encounters, you start to like empathize with him a little. Like, oh man, that's annoying, right? And you could almost see that with the police officers. And so for me, knowing and getting to know the parents and understanding being from the community, this is such a gigantic slap in the face. And you can't allow somebody like that to control and dominate that narrative. It's just not going to fly for us. And so it is important to state why he had such a visceral reaction to these Muslim students. And it's important for our society to know that there are people like Craig Hicks out there in the world. There are people who see the hijab, for instance, as the symbol of, I don't know, in their heads, oppression, or, you know, that Islam for some reason hates America. I mean, you have presidential candidates like Donald Trump that very next year saying that on national television to Anderson Cooper. And so we're trying to communicate to the world that like that kind of rhetoric, that kind of belief like this.
Professor Kennedy?
Yeah, so I'd say one thing about the part of the film that shows the interrogation. I wouldn't assume for a second that the police officers bought or believed anything that he said about why he committed those killings. And I haven't spoken to police officers, but what I saw in there is sort of a classic interrogation technique that the police use, which is moral minimization. They want to create a rapport with the suspect. And so what they do is they sort of give the suspect an out. They sort of provide some sort of, they minimize what was done in some way to get the suspect talking. And then what you have, the result is he admits to the killing. He admits to the shooting. Now, those are things the prosecution no longer has to prove.
Yeah, he's your friend now.
Yeah.
They try to get to that point. Well, I'm here with Tariq Al-Baba, filmmaker, director of 36 Seconds, Portrait of a Hate Crime. Also in the room with me is Satana DeBerry, district attorney for Durham County, and Joseph Kennedy, a professor of law at UNC Chapel Hill. D.A. DeBerry, you know, what about anything strike you as, I don't know, very clear or maybe a little unclear when you think about the film? Was there anything that you had to say, I need to see this again?
About the film?
Mm-hmm. Any parts, especially when we're talking about like the interrogation part, and, you know, there's a lot of layers.
Well, with the exception of Craig Hicks, I and the assistant district attorney, who's now judge, who worked on this case, Kendra Montgomery Blinn, we are probably the two, the people who know the most about what happened that night, because unfortunately, Dia recorded his death and the death of his wife and her sister. And I think the thing, I myself, all due respect, Tariq, hope to never see that movie again. Mm-hmm. It was going through that case and the sentencing phase of it were very emotional. We spent a lot of time with the families preparing for it, and the sentencing itself was very emotional, very traumatic, and really seeing that film in February just brought all that rushing back. And one of the it was very well done, and the thing I said is I hope to never see it again. But I do want to address this idea that it was a parking dispute and how that got into the narrative. In the movie, Chief Blue explains that he really wanted to let people know that these victims were, that the broader community was not in danger. And except when you're a let's say, a diverse person, right? So when you're a person of color, when you're a person who practices a faith that is in the minority where you are, you already know that you're a targeted person. And I think what really was a cognitive dissonance for the Muslim community during this time is that they knew they were being targeted. They knew, despite what Chief Blue had said, that
there's and he's the police chief of Chapel Hill.
He's the police chief of, he's the former police chief.
The former police chief of Chapel Hill.
Of Chapel Hill. And he was doing what he thought was his best to calm a situation that could have gotten out of control. But what I knew, and this is why we need diversity in everything that we do, is that everybody has a, we're all looking at this differently. And immediately when I saw the evidence in this case, which most people have not seen the entirety of it, knew pretty quickly that they had been targeted.
Well, when I think about the film, which was, you know, it's, like you said, it was one of those films that you couldn't turn away no matter, you know, how emotional it was and how emotional you got. But I know one thing, you know, I still have to ask you again, you know, when you, you know, now you're the DA of Durham County and this is dropped in your lap. And did anybody ask you, you know, you need to, we need to bring back the death penalty on this one?
Well, the case originally had been designated a death penalty case. The death penalty had been approved in the case. But I, when I ran, had promised not to use the death penalty. And it was difficult. I'm not going to say it was difficult to stick with that decision. I had already made that decision. And of course, we could have said that decision was made before I was DA and we could have moved forward because it was so horrible. And but we had a lot of conversations with the family. And one of the things that we always talk about is that the death penalty means you revisit this case forever. North Carolina has not executed anybody this century. There are people on death row who continue to appeal their cases, as is their right. And we just, you know, wanted the family to understand that even if a Durham County jury returned a sentence of death, which they probably would not, they have not in a very long time, that it would be on constant appeal. And we would constantly revisit this evidence. We would constantly we see this video. These things would go over and over and over again. And so I don't think that there really wasn't a lot of pushback to continue with the death penalty at that point. What was really important to the family was that we, like Tariq said, told the truth about what had happened and that these three people had been targeted because of their faith.
I guess I'd make a larger point about the death penalty, which is hate crimes are ultimately about dehumanization. You're treating somebody as less than human because of some aspect of their identity. And at the heart of it, the death penalty is also about dehumanization. Because it's never necessary to take someone's life who's going to spend the rest of their life in prison. So in that sense, you're treating them as less than human too. And I think dehumanization just creates more dehumanization.
Well, I'm here with Tariq El-Baba, filmmaker, director of 36 Seconds, Portrait of a Hate Crime. Also, Satana D. Berry, district attorney for Durham County, and Joseph Kennedy, the Martha Brandeis Professor of Law at the University of North Carolina School of Law. We'll continue the conversation after the break. I'm Leonita Inge. This is Due South. This is Due South on WUNC. I'm Leonita Inge. I'm here talking about a story that I wanted to sort of forget about, but of course could not. The 2015 murders of Dia Barakat and Yusur Abu Salha and Yusur's younger sister, Razan Abu Salha, three young Muslim Americans who were gunned down in the home that Dia and you, sir, shared as newlyweds. My guests this hour are Tariq El-Baba, director of a feature documentary about the murders called 36 Seconds, Portrait of a Hate Crime. We also have in the studio Satana D. Berry, district attorney for Durham County, who worked on the case, and Joseph Kennedy of the University of North Carolina School of Law. You know, in our conversation a few minutes ago, we talked a lot about hate crimes and maybe why this particular case did not rise to that level. But we also talked about the film and, I guess, how Craig Hicks, the person who was in prison for the rest of his life for these murders, you know, how he was treated. And I know, Tariq, you made a point of showing, you know, long stretches of really, I don't know if it was interrogation, but I'm thinking you thought maybe he wasn't pushed or really interrogated enough.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's an argument that, you know, it's good police work to create a rapport, to make him feel comfortable. And he's the kind of person, because he felt connected to these white officers, you know, he felt like it was this buddy-buddy situation where he was able to unload and freely give up his life story and why he committed these murders. And I understand that, of course, but for those of us who come from communities of color, we saw it a little bit differently. We saw that there wasn't pointed questions, really. The officers didn't even say the victims' names, not once. And these are Dia Barakat, Razan Abu Salha, Yusur Abu Salha. These are clearly different names from your typical, you know, Chris or Joe or Mary. And then there's two things that you're seeing in the film. So I just want that to be clear. There is the actual confession where he's wearing this Pittsburgh Steelers shirt with I want to note that blood is still on that shirt. And then there's the booking room. So, you know, he gets the mugshot, they change his clothes, they put on the blue jumpsuit. So this is where it's just kind of your boring routine paperwork kind of thing. And there's a very friendly exchange. Of course, he's still being recorded, but you hear things like, I respect you. I respect you taking this on the chin like a man, basically going beyond your investigation and confession type interview. And literally the last sentence that you hear from the police officer in that room before he's taken away is, I wish you the best of luck.
You got a long road ahead of you, man. I wish you luck.
Good road that I made for myself, sir. I appreciate the thought.
I mean, I just, you know, question that. And if the tables were turned,
well,
if
I'm
it
gonna
was
let
an African...
Professor Kennedy, yeah, say, you know, respond to that.
So I know how painful that is to watch and to hear, or I try to imagine how painful that is to hear and watch. But let me say that that's literally, the things they're doing are literally taken from the pages of handbooks that teach police how to interrogate. And it's not just about creating rapport. It literally is about, and if he hadn't given some ridiculous reason for killing them, like the parking thing, they would have suggested one. I mean, two guys kill one guy kills another guy in a bar. They will suggest to the killer, he came at you, didn't he? Because what they're trying to do is they're trying to get him to admit that he killed the other person. I don't know if the police officers had access to the recording at the time they did that interrogation, but their number one goal in that interrogation is, remember, this is an unwitnessed killing. He killed all the witnesses. Their number one goal is to get him to admit that he killed three people. And they successfully did that. Now, with respect to that closing line, which I understand, it's inconceivable why you would say that at the end. They don't know whether this is the last interrogation, right? They might get out of that room and realize we missed something. We've got to go back in. And if he invokes his Miranda rights, that shuts everything down until a lawyer shows up. So as painful as this is to watch, the sort of things I saw them, and I can't peer inside their heads. I never spoke with them. I don't know what exactly they were thinking. But everything I saw is consistent with what police interrogators routinely do over and over again.
Well, D.A. DeBerry, you know, one thing that confuses me, and I don't want to come off as someone who's totally, you know, ignorant right now, but, you know, when this fell into Durham County's lap, into, you know, your office, how come Durham police didn't, you know, it wasn't, you know, before our police officers, like, how did it end up at all in Chapel Hills? I know this family had a Chapel Hill address, but still, I did wonder, you know, how come maybe this murderer wasn't passed on to Durham police, for example?
So there's a lot of jurisdictional and regional nuance that is happening here that just from hearing the news or even watching the film, you wouldn't recognize. So first of all, to Professor Kennedy and Tariq's point about the interrogation, Mr. Hicks drove himself to Chatham County Sheriff's Department. So that is where those initial interviews happened. Chatham County Sheriff has nothing to do with this case. I think our theory of the case is that he drove himself to the Chatham County Sheriff's Department because that is where he thought he would be treated well and where his story would at the very least be accepted on face value. So that's a piece of that. And if you're from around here, you understand why that is, why he would not want to necessarily talk to the Chapel Hill police or the Orange County police.
Or the Durham police.
Well, or the Durham police. As far as why it landed in Durham County, we are here in the Research Triangle Park. Chapel Hill, Orange County, Wake County, and Durham County are very closely situated. There are a lot of places in Chapel Hill that are in Durham County. There are a lot of places in Raleigh that are in Durham County. Almost all of Research Triangle Park itself is in Durham County. But there used to not be people who lived there. Those used to be kind of office parks or woods.
Trees. I was about to say trees.
And there has been a tremendous amount of development. And many of the places that have maybe a Chapel Hill address now are in Durham County, another notorious case from Chapel Hill, the murder of Faith Hedgepeth, is also a Durham County case for just that exact reason, because they lived at an address that was in Durham County.
Mm. You know, I have to, when I think about the film, I think what blew a lot of people away, Tariq, was just, you know, you were able to be there for that sentencing hearing. You know, after we moved on, you know, we know this man is going to prison for the rest of his life. I mean, are you aware of how, you know, how revealing that was? Mainly because, you know, we had the cell phone. I guess some people may not have known that the murders were recorded in that way, and they had never heard them before. You know, it wasn't public. So I guess I'd like to ask you, what did it mean to have that kind of access, to be able to record that sentencing hearing that was, you know, in this film?
Well, there was a lot of gratitude that the district attorney's office allowed us to participate, not only filming the sentencing hearing from the jury box, but also in that pre-trial kind of conference room where the families were discussing, you know, the final verdict of whether or not they wanted to release that video or have it shown in court. And I must say, it was done, you know, we approached them ahead of time with respect and clear communication versus just bombarding them and trying to just say, hey, this is our right as filmmakers, you know. So we wanted to make sure that they were on board, that they understood, you know, who we were and how important, you know, being in that room was. And I had known about it for a long time from the families, and obviously they told me not to say anything and just to kind of prep for things to come. And so being in that room before they got into the court was a really intense moment. I mean, you see the families kind of, there's this discourse of the pros and cons of what this, having this video out into the world could be. And they eventually decided, as you saw in the film, yep, to have it sealed.
Right.
But when I actually saw the video, you know, it's hard to take my filmmaker hat off and not be a community member, not look at Dr. Abu Salha or the Barakat family as you know, extension of my own family. And I was bawling. I mean, it was, you could see the camera shaking at certain points after the video was revealed and we were allowed to put on our camera, turn our cameras back on, because it was just so horrific. And what was really so graphic was hearing Yusor and Razan scream. I mean, you're literally watching and hearing people die in their last moments. And it was incredibly heavy and hard. I mean, at that point, I just wanted to turn the cameras off and just take a deep breath and just be there for the families. But I knew that I had to kind of muster the strength to continue and to capture as much content that I could that day.
You know, I think I never just ask you to explain the title of this film and really, you know, at least explain what 36 seconds Portraits of a Hate Crime means, you know, really that 36 seconds.
You know, with film titles, it's something that's always an evolution. You always have a working title. I think very few films have a title that they stick with from the very beginning. But, you know, we just thought it was so symbolic. You know, it was 36 seconds that ended these three brilliant lives. And they also, 36 also kept on coming up. You know, the police interviewed 36 neighbors in the neighborhood. And we wanted it to be absolutely clear that this was a hate crime. So to, in fact, have a portrait of a hate crime, to me, demonstrated a very clear stance on what had happened. But also, in a way, it tipped your hat to the nuance, right? Because to this day, if you look up this case, it wasn't a hate crime. It's still not classified as a hate crime. It's not in the FBI statistics as a hate crime. But here we are. We all know that it was. And so that's kind of what led us to create that title.
Well, D.A. DeBerry, why did you find it important for it to be filmed, to even allow Tariq to film the sentencing?
Well, it was important for us to have in the court record what had happened. And so we put on evidence of bias. We had a bias expert testify at the sentencing hearing. The families testified. And as Tariq said, we showed the video, which up until that point had not been public. No one knew other than the parties what was in the evidence, that video had been in evidence. And so it was, as a public servant, one of my core values is transparency. And we really wanted people to know that irrespective of the tools that we had as prosecutors, we recognized that there was bias in this case, that these people were murdered because of the way Mr. Hicks felt about their religious expression. And we wanted as many people to hear that story as possible. And, you know, in this day and age, the way that you have as many people hear your story as possible is you videotape, you record it. You put that out into the public record as well as the court record.
Professor Kennedy, has anything changed since this particular case? You know, did this case actually spur any change when it comes to strengthen any legislation, or where are we now even after this huge example?
Yeah, no change that I'm aware of in North Carolina. Unfortunately, this problem is ongoing, right? The problem of bias and hate will probably always be with us. You know, the laws that exist for dealing with it are always going to be sort of insufficient. I mean, the criminal justice system has two different functions, right? It has this function of every day adjudicating guilt and innocence and sentencing people. And it has this expressive function of sending messages to society. What hate crimes statutes try to do is they try to serve that expressive function, right? And reject the message that some people are worth less than others.
What'd you say, D.A. DeBerry, if there's no hate, it's because people don't want them. If they don't have any hate crimes, I guess in one's community, they're not there because people haven't fought hard enough for them.
Right. And the night that we saw the video, my friend Senator Jay Chaudhary was on the panel, and Senator Chaudhary has literally every term that he's been in the North Carolina General Assembly proposed a bill to codify hate crimes in North Carolina law, and every time that he has proposed it, it has never made it into the North Carolina statutes. And I think I said that night, we track what we care about.
Right.
And some of us know better than others of us that there are people who do not care about our lives.
Well, we have to wrap up this conversation now, but thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tariq Al-Baba, his award-winning feature documentary, 36 Seconds, Portrait of a Hate Crime, is being screened really across the country. And also thank you very much to Professor Joe Kennedy of the UNC School of Law and Durham County District Attorney Satana DeBerry. This is Due South. Due South is a production of WUNC and a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Coldell Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Denarius Thomas is our technical director. Aaron Kiever is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Quilla. Jeff DeBerry is my co-host, and I'm Leonita Inge. For more Due South, go to duesouthradio.org. Download and subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen.